Okay, we're back for episode 122, if I'm correct. 122 of Powers and Principalities. Joe, how you doing?
I'm just fine, Tim. And tonight we agreed that we would talk about Ronald Reagan, the Gipper. But before we get started, I know that we were censored by YouTube with our last show. I got a couple emails trying to figure out what had happened. Do you want to describe what happened?
They pulled the video, claiming it violated community standards, guidelines, whatever. There's no content to the video that I posted. It just has the introduction music and maybe a few photographs. I did have the word, the acronym ZOG in the description, so maybe that triggered something. But that's it.
Well, I mean, even for censorship, it's kind of a low blow, you know, so... Silly.
You know, like I said, I'm using YouTube to link to other sites, but you can listen to or watch the video in its entirety. So that's what I use YouTube now for, because it's completely useless because of the censorship there. As a information site now I guess you're fine if you're posting water skating squirrels or piano playing kittens or soft pornography, but you can't have any meaningful content, political or social content on there.
They banned Red Eyes this week.
Yes, I heard about that, yeah. They pulled all their videos.
Yeah, I mean, they absolutely banned it and just destroyed it, which is, I've been on that show a number of times and, chatted it up with Henrik. I hope he's got some kind of a model to, work around so that he isn't too damaged by this. But it is just, you can see it's a good sign, though. I mean,
they're desperate.
We're cutting. We are performing the correct role of critics in a democracy. And the oligarchs and their minions cannot stand it. So rather than attempt to engage us in dialogue, they're trying to censor us, but hopefully the public will be aware of the meaning of the censorship. It isn't because we're bad people. It's because we talk about controversial stuff and they cannot respond, I think. So that was the week that was, but this is the week that is. Now, Ronald Reagan, Tim, the Gipper. What do we know about this guy?
Well, Ronald Reagan, okay, full name Ronald Wilson Reagan, was born in February 6, 1911, in Tampico, Illinois, and he passed away on June 5, 2004, in Los Angeles, California. He was the 48th president of the United States, serving in that office 1981 into 1989. He was noted for his conservative beliefs. He was a conservative Republican. He was known to be a fervent anti-communist, a cold warrior. He had an appealing personal style. He had an affable public persona. And considered kind of folksy, self-deprecating. So he appealed to a lot of people, and he was a very charming politician. He was the second child of John Edward Jack Reagan, a struggling shoe salesman, and Nellie Wilson Reagan. Reagan's nickname, Dutch, derived from his father's habit of referring to his infant son as the fat little Dutchman. After several years of moving from town to town, made necessary by his father's alcoholism, which made it difficult for him to hold a job, the family settled in Dixon, Illinois in 1920. There, he was a popular student. He was elected class president in his senior year, graduating in 1932 with a bachelor's degree in economics and sociology. So he was a college boy, which is then a rarity. He decided to enter radio broadcasting. He landed a job as a sportscaster at station WOC in Davenport, Iowa, by delivering entirely from memory an exciting play-by-play description of a Eureka College football game. Later, he moved to station WHO in Des Moines, where as sportscaster Dutch Reagan, he became became popular throughout the state for his broadcast of the Chicago Cubs baseball game. There's a story where one time back then the announcer would not be at the field; he would read play by play by I think by ticker tape, he'd get updates on the scores, and then he'd make it seem like he was at the game. And there was some story where one time the news feed stopped for some reason, and he had to improvise. In 1937, Reagan followed the Cubs to their spring training camp in Southern California, a trip he undertook partly in order to try his hand at movie acting. After a successful screen test at Warner Brothers, he was soon typecast in a series of mostly B-movies as a sincere, wholesome, easygoing good guy. As many observers have noted, the characters that Reagan portrayed in his movies were remarkably like Reagan himself. During the next 27 years, he appeared in more than 50 films, most notably Newt Rockne, All-American, King's Row, and The Hasty Heart. At the outbreak of World War II, he was commissioned as a cavalry officer, but he was assigned to an Army film unit based in Los Angeles. He never saw combat. I think that he met Jane Wyman, his first wife. After the war, Hollywood became known for occasionally telling stories about his past, about the war. Some say he confused his movie roles with his actual, with his actual experience. He was an admirer of Franklin Delano Roosevelt, despite later becoming a Republican. This is maybe people attribute this to the fact his father landed a New Deal job in the 1930s. From 1947 to 1952, Reagan served as president of the Union of Movie Actors, the Screen Actors Guild. There he was said to fight communist infiltration, and also he would cross picket lines to break sometimes violent strikes. Reagan, as governor of California, called out the National Guard to restore order many times. He didn't like public violence and violent public protests. Much to the disgust of union members, he testified as a friendly witness before the House Un-American Activities Committee and cooperated in the blacklisting of actors, directors, and writers suspected of leftist sympathies. Although Reagan was still a Democrat at the time, he campaigned for Harry Truman in the presidential election of 1948. His political opinions were gradually growing more conservative. After initially supporting Democratic senatorial candidate Helen Douglas in 1950, he switched his allegiance to Republican Richard Nixon midway through the campaign. It was at this time that Reagan met Nancy Davis, later Nancy Reagan, a relatively unknown actress, at a dinner party in 1949. And the two were married in a simple ceremony in 1952. William Holden was the best man. After his acting career began to decline in the 1950s, Reagan became the host of the television drama series General Electric Theater, as well as a spokesman for General Electric Company. In the latter capacity, he toured GE plants around the country, delivering inspirational speeches with a generally conservative pro-business message. Eventually, however, his speech became too controversial, and he was relieved or fired from that job. Reagan campaigned actively for Nixon in his run for governor of California in 1962 and supported the presidential candidacy of conservative Republican Barry Goldwater in 1964, serving as co-chairman of California Republicans for Goldwater. In the last week of the campaign, he delivered a 30-minute nationally televised address, A Time for Choosing, that the Washington Post described as the most successful political debut since William Jennings Bryan electrified the 1896 Democratic Convention with his Cross of Gold speech. Reagan's speech, which resulted in $1 million in campaign contributions for Republican candidates, catapulted him into the national political stage and made him an instant hero for the Republican right. In 1966, Reagan announced his candidacy for governor, running against the incumbent Democratic governor, Edmund G. Pat Brown, who had defeated Nixon in 1962. Pat Brown ridiculed Reagan's lack of experience, declaring that while he had been serving in public, Reagan was making Bedtime for Bonzo, a 1951 movie in which Reagan starred with a chimpanzee. But Reagan turned this apparent liability into an asset by portraying himself as an ordinary citizen who was fed up with the state of government that had become inefficient and unaccountable. The public also reacted well to Reagan's personality, in particular his apparent genuineness, affability, and self-deprecating sense of humor. When asked by a reporter how he would perform in office, Reagan replied, "I don't know. I've never played a governor." Reagan won the election by nearly 1 million votes. During his two terms of governor, 1967 through 1975, Reagan erased a substantial budget deficit inherited from the Brown administration and instituted reforms in the state's welfare programs. Reagan made a half-hearted bid for the Republican presidential nomination in 1968 as and finishing third behind Nixon and former New York Governor Nelson Rockefeller. During his remaining years as governor, he made plans for a more serious run for the presidency, expecting that his chance would come in 1976 at the anticipated end of Nixon's second term. But Nixon's resignation in 1974 put Vice President Gerald Ford in the Oval Office. Unwilling to wait another 8 years, Reagan challenged Ford with a blistering critique of his policies, but lost the nomination by 60 votes at the convention. Reagan, of course, 1980 ran for the presidency again. This time he was successful, defeating George W. Bush, who would be George H. W. Bush, rather, who would eventually become his vice president. That campaign, of course, ran against Jimmy Carter. Jimmy Carter, of course, was running against. Well, he had a rough time. He proved kind of feckless. The economy performed poorly. There was, of course, the Iran hostage crisis, which factored greatly into his defeat, and Reagan won a landslide victory on November 1980. I think winning 41 states, I believe, of 50, if I remember, in a three-way race between Jimmy Carter and, I guess, the John Anderson. I think it was a third-party candidate that year. The Reagan presidency, of course, 1981 to 1989. We can get into some of that. He slashed taxes in 1981. Of course, you had the in 1983, there was the Marine barracks bombing in Lebanon, and also the invasion of Grenada, I think 2 days later. I wonder why that took place. Of course, we can get into things like the Iranian hostage crisis and perhaps the October surprise conspiracy theory or scandal. Of course, there's Iran-Contra. But Reagan, despite these scandals, Reagan did leave office very popular president in 1989, rating very high among the American people. And that his political career. We can get into, of course, what was really behind Reagan's political career. There's a lot of connections to the mob, of course. Lou Wasserman, MCA, Jules Steins, and that was sort of Reagan's benefactor when it sponsored him. And he was sort of a tool for MCA when he was at the Screen Actors Guild and also when he was the governor. And we can get into a general discussion about, of course, the political figures like Reagan. And, of course, the underworld, or at least the unterworld that really exists and really governs the country and really are the hands that are, at least the people who are pulling the strings for these political marionettes we call politicians. So, Joe, what do you have to say about Ronald Reagan?
Well, Reagan was a lifetime actor. He wasn't just a bedtime for Bonzo companion to the chimp, but rather he was someone who had been developed by the secret society.
Well, for Joe, people. There you go again.
God, I know. It's crazy. I can't help it. You know, but that's just how I see him. Are you there?
I'm here.
Okay. Okay. So anyway, so, Reagan, you know, his to try to understand Reagan as a lifetime actor, you have some markers. I mean, the first one is the fact he was a member of Bohemian Grove, right, which is sort of an annex of Freemasonry. Don't think we have to go into that too much, but I think it's obviously a red flag. Secondly, he chose the Skull and Bone member, Bush Sr., as his running mate. Didn't really need to do this, but did. So this is another marker, little curiosity. And then probably less sort of scandalous, but the fact is he was one of the people who was brought in to Lookout Mountain. And I think that's pretty important because you know, you have Disney and Marilyn Monroe, a few other actors as well. But, you know, obviously this is, you know, there's something going on there. And I think what actually happened was this was where Reagan was basically trained in the persona that, you know, self-effacing kind of, you know, how would you, the Gipper, right? He was this lovable kind of character of the pixelated world, and I think that this was where he would have been developed in this way. I mean, you know, they were obviously doing something up there. This is a conjecture, but they certainly weren't there for, you know, Marilyn Monroe and Reagan were not there to contribute to the scientific progress of the place. So there had to be something else that they were doing. And I just suspect that was where Reagan was, his personality was developed, and his screen personality, the persona that he gave to the public. I kind of have a personal opinion about Reagan's, the self-effacing Ronald Reagan, you know, with this, that kind of grin he has, you know, and that, because I met Reagan. I met him, I'm not sure of the year, but I met him between the time that he was governor and before his successful campaign. So it was between 76 and 80. And I met him in a place called Trancas Market, which is on the ocean at the very northern end of Malibu. And Malibu has kind of, in the southern side, you know, there's kind of beach life and restaurants, and it's very chic. But the northern end gets kind of wilderness-like. There's not really a lot going on. And this grocery store is really very, you know, Trancas Market. It's very low-key kind of deal. But Reagan lived at that time in Malibu. This is before he moved to Santa Barbara. His ranch is up Refugio Canyon here in Santa Barbara. I've been there because I live actually in Santa Barbara and have traveled to it. But I, at that point, I was in Malibu, and I was in Trancas Market buying something, and there he was. He came right down the aisle, and our eyes met, and we was, you know, kind of, we didn't say anything, didn't talk, and Nancy was with him. She was off to another site. And I wanted just to mention, I had a very strong reaction about him. One, he was incredibly physically powerful. I mean, he looked like a weightlifter. I was shocked because I knew who he was. I mean, he had already been governor and I'd seen him, but he was wearing a jumpsuit with short sleeves. And I was just astonished at how physically powerful he was. And then the second thing is that his skin was really dark. I've never quite understood how the pictures of him in the pixelated reality show him as such a light-skinned individual. I think even there he's kind of dark, but he was much darker. And I don't think it was tan. I just think he had very dark complexion. And then finally, he was spooky. I didn't understand it at the time. I thought maybe he was just bad vibing, you know, to keep, like, because he'd been governor and maybe, you know, there was no Secret Service around him. I think he'd already had the unsuccessful run for presidency, but there was no one around. It was just him and Nancy. And they lived up one of the canyons and had come down, you know, maybe for you know, a blood meal. I mean, I don't know what was going on, but anyway, so there was Ronnie and I, and he was very, very sinister. I really thought this guy was someone you had to be very careful around. You know, I mean, he was definitely a fighter. And I had been a bouncer in a bar in college. And so I had a kind of sense about, you know, just who you had to pay attention to in terms of fighting. And what kind of, you know, like response you had to give, you know. And this guy was off the chart. That was my sense. I thought, God, he is someone you really, you know, if you're going to fight this guy, you got to go for the knockout punch immediately because he's mean. Anyway, you know, then that was my sense. And then later he pops up in the 80s as our president. And suddenly he's just this very sweet, self-effacing guy, and I was always shocked by that. It was just like I just never quite got the relationship, and now I do, of course. Now I can see that, you know, if you're going to be a high-level secret society agent, you're sort of in on the deal, and you have to be accepting of, you know, just vast murder. You know, I mean, the scale of, you know, of like geopolitical murder, you really have to have a kind of psychopathic, is how I would describe a personality. And so that's what I was actually experiencing. And so anyway, that was my take on Reagan. And then I just want to, if you don't mind, it'll just take a few minutes, but I want to show that. So you have these markers to me of Reagan, you know, secret society guy, lifetime actor. But the real kind of the most important one is not known to people. I am aware of it and have looked at it, studied it, but it's not something that people would even, no one has even a clue that it ever occurred. Reagan was a proponent of what was called the invisible man. Now, this is a story that comes into, you know, American lexicon through George Lippard. He's a Freemason, friend of Edgar Allan Poe, the Masonic cesspool. And Lippard had recorded that there had been this story, which basically was at the founding of America. And the story was that everyone was frightened to sign the Declaration of Independence. Okay, this was like in Philadelphia, July 4th, 1776, a critical day in American history. And this is supposedly a true story, or at least it's related as such. And Manly Hall is actually the one who then took Lippard's stuff and kind of brought it into whatever degree of awareness the American public has about, which is basically zero. But anyway, so there they are. The delegates are there in 1776, July 4th, and everyone is frightened. No one wants to do it. And suddenly a mysterious speaker comes forward and he gives this, you know, like kind of rallying speech, which says that you have to overcome your fears of being hanged or beheaded. You have to, you know, like make the freedom and the destiny of America come to pass. And, Hall says one of the agents of the secret order was this individual, and he was directing the destiny of America. And then so the delegates then were all, you know, they were basically, you know, rallied and they voted for the Declaration of Independence. And then when they went to thank the speaker who had appeared out of nowhere, he couldn't be found. And no one to this day, according to Manly Hall and to the people who recorded it, can explain how he entered or left the guarded room. And he's known as the Invisible Man, right? This is actually a story that Manly Hall recorded in his book on Freemasonry. And he said that that this guy was an important kind of Masonic element because he was the Invisible Man. Now, so the Invisible Man is a concept of Masonry. I won't go into it too far here, but the idea is that Freemasons, you know, they have a visible side, which is kind of the Shriners Hospital, and then the invisible side, which is the political animating history side. And this side is kept secret, so it's always invisible. That's why when you see like Stalin or Napoleon, they have their hand tucked in their jacket, right? Because it's the invisible hand. So this is a story about the invisible man. And Ronald Reagan, in his 1957 commencement address to his alma mater, Eureka College, he then basically tried to inspire the students with this aspect of Masonic occult history. And he says, you know, this is his quoting, and he goes, "This is the land of destiny, and our forefathers found their way here by some divine system of selective service, gathered here to fulfill a mission to advance man a further step in his climb from the swamps." And he then retold the story, but he didn't mention Manly Hall. He said that, you know, at the end, when they went to thank the speaker for, you know, like inspiring and basically creating America, he couldn't be found. And to this day, no one knows who he was or how he ended up left the discarded room. And then he repeated the story again in Parade magazine just after he left the office. Basically, the presidential aide, Michael Deaver, delivered to like Parade magazine, which was a personal essay on what July the 4th meant. And so this was from Camp David, and Reagan retold the story, and you know, he says when he couldn't find the guy and stuff. Well, anyway, this is basically, you know, the story is just completely ridiculous, but it is a representation of the invisible aspect of Freemasonry. which there's in my mind, there's no question, but you know, Reagan was part of. And so this is, I think, the fact that he, you know, uses this as like the introduction of American democracy. He has this very, very occulted Masonic story, which makes no sense whatsoever on any level, unless you're, you know, like a someone who's on the inside, it's part of the invisible side of Freemasonry. And then it makes perfect sense. The invisible character is just a legacy of the invisible Mason who was in back of all of the, you know, process that by which the independent American independence, so-called, was brought about. And so that's my take on Reagan, is that he's just an obvious lifetime actor. And of course he is, because, you know, you couldn't get to that level of American politics if you weren't in the club. So he has to represent himself as something he's not. He's been trained well to do this. But he does lead from time to time little clues so that we can, you know, now we're able to, you know, see him in a clearer light, because post 9/11, you know, we know the secret society's there. We know it's malevolent. We know it has been in control for a long period of time. And Reagan was part of it.
Yeah, it's Reagan, of course. Much of his campaigning, when his political career, whether it was governor of California or president of the United States, was railing against big government, going to shake things up. Government's the problem. But each time that he left the office, government was bigger.
Shock.
In absolute terms. So it's one of these things where, again, another politician campaigning, performing as a... As a reformer, man outside the system, he's going to shake the system up. Doesn't do it, of course. If you follow Ronald Reagan's political career and who sponsored him, I touched on this in the introduction. Of course, you have, when he came to California in search of becoming an actor, his talent agency was bought out by Music Corporation of America, MCA, which is then owned by Jules Stein, who was a ophthalmologist turned music promoter, mobster from Chicago, who used very unethical methods to expand his business. He would, you know, threaten to burn down hotels that didn't hire his band and beat people up and maybe worse. And because when the outfit moved out to California, a lot of the Jewish mobsters went out there, and Jules Stein, I guess, teamed up with Lou Wasserman. And Lou Wasserman kind of took over, and he became sort of the Hollywood mogul at you know, MCA. And pretty much Ronald Reagan was Lou Wasserman's tool at the Screen Actors Guild. He's the one that got the waiver so they could be involved not only in representing, being a talent agency, but also in movie production. And he got the waiver passed, and in return, he was given this job with General Electric. And there's also all types of shady financial and also real estate dealings that enriched Reagan, got him out of debt a couple times and these things. So he was able to enrich himself working for, you know, Lou Wasserman and Sidney Korshak and these mobsters who were really running the show out in California. You know, we've talked about in our talk about organized crime and politics, what was going on in California. This really doesn't distinguish Ronald Reagan much, because the Browns, Pat Brown, the man he defeated, and his son came back, I think, succeeded Reagan as governor, Jerry Brown, and until fairly recent was governor, still, multiple terms of governor. But the Browns had their back, and I think it was Ziffrin, was this mob-connected lawyer that was his political backer. Even, I believe, Richard Nixon, another California politician, had the backing of Jimmy Hoffa. And that was largely because of Hoffa didn't like the Kennedys or something, because of Bobby Kennedy's crusade of the Justice Department against certain factions of the mob. Of course, then there's the Kennedys, who's, you know, of course, the patriarch of the Kennedy family, Joe Kennedy, was heavily involved in bootlegging, got into movies, went out to Hollywood like other mobsters did. But, of course, he had connections to the mob, and he used some of those connections in 1960 to help his son get elected president. I think this was in Illinois. So these type of shenanigans going behind the scenes are very common in politics. Harry Truman, and we talked about this, came from the Pendergast machine. And California itself, California politics around the 1940s and into the latter half of the 20th century, you had this Jewish mafia that was ascendant and large, helped greatly by the seizure of Japanese property. And I think it was Harry Bazelon who was during the Truman administration was given the position of selling seized property of German and Japanese, and he gave him a lot of his friends and buddies. And one beneficiary was the Crown family. The Crown family got a lot of mines and very valuable real estate for pennies on the dollar. And this was all done inside dealing. And then Bazelton got a piece of the action. He got rich and very corrupt. So the whole power structure in California is largely based on theft and these things and organized crime. So the whole scene is very, very corrupt, very sleazy. And the funny thing about it is that, of course, you would think that this sleazy background would be reported on the mainstream press, and it wasn't. Even, you know, critics of Reagan wouldn't talk about these things. So the press is controlled. It's just one of these things where, just below the surface, you see that if you do a little digging, you see the true nature of the system. And these political figures, they're all mobbed up. And so when we talk about the mob and politics and government, there's not much of a distinction there. So they're all interlinked. And everything else, and the whole scene or political scene is really just a show.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely right. I mean, I hate to be a cynic, but I mean, I would just say like Charlie Manson would be like a kind of a middle of the road California politician. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just an absolute cesspool. Interesting thing about Reagan, and you know, you mentioned his relationship to Jewish mobsters, is that Ronald was, of course, a huge Zionist.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm trying to find, and perhaps like people in the audience can help with my research here, I'm trying to find like either a Skull and Bone or Bohemian Grove member that isn't a Zionist. I can't find anyone that really, you know, you'd think that such a controversial political situation would have some, interest on both sides, but I can't find anyone. They all seem to be 100% into Zionism. And you know, last week in our censored Zog show, we brought up the concept of the State of Israel, its legal basis, as kind of like a quark, something that is both matter and light. It changes, you know, it's a religious state, it's a political state, you know, it can be whatever it wants to be because it's never actually ratified a constitution, so it doesn't even actually have any legal boundaries as far as anyone knows. But Reagan actually gave kind of the very first example of this. There had been the Dome of the Rock shooting. There was a deranged Israeli gunman who got in there and killed a lot of people. I forget how many. But so Reagan instructed his delegates, I think it was Gene Kirkpatrick, if I'm not mistaken, to the UN to veto any resolution which characterized East Jerusalem, where this occurred, as occupied territory. And he said that the final status on Jerusalem needed to be negotiated and was not subject to resolution by legal fiat. So this is pretty funny because here we are like, you know, 40 years later and it still hasn't got resolved. Reagan, he claims to have seen original footage of the Holocaust. I don't know if you ever heard this particular aspect, but he says that somehow he was in the film branch during World War II and was given access to this documentation of the Holocaust. And he actually brought this up quite a number of times because because he said he was afraid that at some point in the future the Holocaust might be doubted. Mm-hmm. Somewhat amazingly prescient, isn't it? You know, yeah. But that actually occurred. That he claims to have seen this footage, and that, you know, he would bring it up on the grounds that he would need to remind people about the legitimacy of the act or the historical event because he was afraid that in the future someone might doubt it. But he had seen this. So, you know, and just this during his tenure, you know, there was all kinds of just problem after problem in Israel, but he would just relentlessly stand in back of them. And he was very much, in this instance, in the instance of the State of Israel, he was very hands-on. He wasn't hands-on in a lot of areas. He was more laissez-faire. But here, he would actually micromanage even the words that... you know, he evidently wouldn't let the word aggression be used in a statement occurring in the United Nations when in June 7th, 1981, Israeli bombed the Iraq nuclear reactor. Mm-hmm. And so there was going to be a UN resolution, but he said, no, you cannot have the word aggression. And so...
that was a UN-approved civilian nuclear reactor, yeah.
Yep. And so you can see that, you know, he was 100% Zionist, and it's kind of peculiar in the sense that the political reality of Israel is complicated, and yet there wasn't, you know, any complication in his response. He was 100% Zionist, and I just think it's strange that I can't find any, you know, I mean, if you look at like Skull and Bones, for example, I mean, you've got the Bush family, William F. Buck. I mean, they're just, you have the biggest Zionists imaginable. It's just odd. And then finally, you know, Reagan brought a team around him. He had advisors. And this was really, it's very important to go through this list because this is really where the neocons come. I mean, the neocons are thought to have emerged from Bush Sr., but actually Irving Kristol and Norman Poderetz, Rostow, these guys were actually all working in different forms in the Reagan election campaign. And
Pearl and Elliot Abrams, yeah.
So Reagan, even though he somehow skates on this issue, neoconservatism, the stuff that brings us 9/11 and then the endless wars, it really starts here. You know, starts with the Gipper.
Yeah. We can, of course, I kind of alluded to it, but some of the more interesting, at least intrigues of the Reagan administration, you have, of course, the election of 1980 when he defeated Jimmy Carter. There is the October surprise thing where the Reagan campaign was upset or concerned that should the hostages be released before the election, that might give Jimmy Carter a bump in the poll and secure his re-election. And some people have accused the Reagan campaign of negotiating behind the scenes with the revolutionary Iranian government to delay the release of the hostages. In the whole scheme of things, I don't think that's too far beyond the pale or outlandish. I mean, considering what was at stake, is it Ghorbanifar, the Iranian president, who said that he had met with George W. H.W. Bush and William Bill Casey at a Ritz-Carlton in Paris to negotiate this deal. And of course the date books for those two men are blank for those days, supposedly that their appointment book or their calendar or their diaries, and so there's no they can't account for their whereabouts on those supposed meeting days when they allegedly met, you know, at the Ritz-Carlton. But the arms deals did go through. This was handled through Israel, and basically what happened was, what was going on there, of course, the deal was if you delay the release till after the election. And of course, they were released on the inauguration day, Reagan's inauguration day, almost simultaneous to his inauguration, that Iran would receive much needed armaments and supplies, because at the time they were at war with Iraq, and there was there's an 8-9 year war with Iraq that was largely fomented, or at the very least extended, by the United States, by actually arming and aiding both sides simultaneously. And so this was going to secure the shipment of arms. Same thing would also factor in the Iran-Contra scandal, at least one aspect of it. So that's an interesting thing there, that, you know, some people have claimed that, you know, that that's what the Reagan campaign did. There's some say that Reagan might not have been directly involved in that, but yeah, I could see that. But obviously, you know, figures like George H.W. Bush and Bill Casey, who are, you know, certainly capable of doing that type of thing. After all, they are spies. so that's one of the things that sort of casts a shadow over the Reagan administration. Of course, then there's Iran-Contra, where not only were they illegally shipping arms, you know, to Iran, and trading arms for hostages, and then down to Nicaragua to fight the Contras, who were waging a war against the Sandinista regime. But in the process of doing that, they, in order to pay for this operation, the CIA had facilitated the shipments of cocaine into the United States, that helped feed the war on drugs, but also led a lot of, you know, some people say it contributed to the crack addiction in L.A. in the 80s, because the proceeds were being used to pay for the much of the war effort down there. It's Oliver North got caught up in this, and actually they have memos. Oliver North has memos talking about the drug shipments and looking at the life and career of Barry Seal and these things. So it's very, very, very dirty, very murky. This angle was sort of covered up. At least when it was investigated by the Kerry Commission, it just they kind of mentioned that it happened. It didn't go any further. But the CIA was involved in, you know, shipping in drugs in the United States to pay for some of these operations overseas. This isn't a news story. They've been doing this for decades. This was just the Central American operation. Obviously, we've talked about Vietnam and the heroin trade there, the role that played in that conflict. And even today, you have, in Afghanistan, the poppy fields, why our troops are still there. And they're securing the poppy fields and maintain the flow of heroin into the West. But that went on during, of course, the Reagan administration. I don't necessarily believe Reagan was involved or was really necessarily even knew about it, because these type of things happen far below that office, and it's the middlemen. And certainly I think George Bush was involved in it as head of the National Security Council. He was in a position to misdirect or hold off any real investigation in these things, and which is why when he became president, the Manuel Noriega was taken out and arrested. Manuel Noriega was on $100,000 a year stipend from the CIA, and was, good friends with George H.W. Bush for many years, because he was facilitating the shipment of drugs through his country, and also helping support the counter-war effort.
Yeah, I mean, the events of history that were given, I know this is a position that would be hard for many of, like, the normal people to accept, but I think a lot of this stuff is just stagecraft, and that they create these dialectics so that we can root one side of the event or the other, and they even like will give us stuff like the Iran Contra or the Clinton Lewinsky. I think these things are really just stagecraft, and I think that Reagan is interesting because he is an actor. It's sort of like when you talk about the triumph of the pixelated reality, you really have to look to Reagan as a centerpiece, because he was really, a real actor, or at least who was in the pixelated world with Bedtime for Bonzo and all of his other films. But, the most famous, of course, the one he's best known for was where he played George Gipp. Mm-hmm. And I think that even there, I would be amazed if a lot of the roles he was being given wasn't occurring with the understanding of that they were going to basically, eventually use him politically. So I don't know where they picked him up, but I would, you know, I think it was probably fairly early in his life.
Well, I think they probably have a stable of potential.
Yeah, that's right. He was just a stable. In other words, they wouldn't be able to, like, you know, like select one individual. But I think that he was just sort of a, you know, in the secret society stable and just being managed as he came forward. I mean, he didn't end up at Bohemian Grove as a member of a Bohemian Grove because of his role at Bedtime for Bonzo.
Yeah, it's one thing. Like, ever follow Nixon's ascendancy?
Yeah,
and you can infer a different explanation of his political rise. But some say, because he was in naval intelligence, or he was in the Navy during World War II, and in that position he was given access to a lot of intelligence, particularly some of the dealings of Dulles and the elder Bush. You know, what's his name? Bush's father. Prescott Bush.
Prescott, yeah.
And some say that he was able, in that position, because the official story is that Nixon answered an ad did they do that? This is how they did it then? And answered an ad in the paper to run for Congress against this guy who was like a thorn in the side of the bankers or something. I think that's the story. And he answered the ad, and it was off for the races for Nixon. But I've read that actually Nixon had some information on some of the dealings of Prescott Bush, the Union Bank, and during the war, and used as leverage for Prescott Bush to sponsor Nixon. And so Prescott Bush is the one that sponsored Nixon's career. And this factors in the Watergate years later, because one of these days we should probably, because it's in the news, maybe next week we'll do, as maybe do impeachment or something.
Yeah, that'd be kind of fun.
Because this thing. But it's been very trivialized lately. But we'll get into that and talk about it next week maybe. And so what happened was when Nixon doesn't pick Bush as his vice president, the machinations of Watergate start happening. Yeah. You know, so there's all types of levels of drama, political drama going on here. Needless to say, the public isn't given anything close to the real story to these things. What do you make of something like Reagan, the assassination attempt?
Well, I would have to say it's probably legit. I mean, these people do create bad feelings, mm-hmm. and particularly, you know, the individual was crazy. The only thing is, if I'm not mistaken, I think he had a copy of Catcher in the Rye.
Yeah. Yeah, same with John Lennon's legend.
Right, and so that tells me that this is obviously this is stagecraft. I mean, I don't know why they meant to kill Reagan, but I don't know. I mean, I hate to say it because this would make people think I'm believing in conspiracy theory, but I'm not even sure that he was actually shot. You know, I mean, the whole thing just seems so strange to me. And I think if I recall right, that the assassin had dinner with one of the members of the Bush family. His father had dinner with one of the members of
Bush. Yeah, John Hinckley was friends. John Hinckley's brother was friends with Neil Bush. Yeah. They were supposed to have dinner the next night. It was reported on NBC News, John Chancellor. He goes, if you can believe in coincidences, he goes, it just reported once, and that's it.
Yeah, and then he just happens to have, you know, Catcher in the Rye. I mean, no, I think that there's some kind of Masonic, you know, thing going on. Maybe the Reagan pissed off the controllers and they decided to, you know, give him a lesson, in which case that would, you know, explain it. Or maybe the whole thing was just some kind of, you know, they traumatized the public. And we don't always necessarily understand what the trauma is for.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, like Reagan, he released almost all of the, asylum individuals in California. You couldn't keep people basically against their will, even if they were stark raving mad. And this was a huge trauma against culture, because suddenly you had people who were just schizophrenic in the streets.
Yeah.
And there was, you know, he said it was budget, but people were kind of confused by this because these people were costing more money in the public than they were costing in incarcerated. But, you know, you when you have these things occur, I just think you're better off trying to understand them as, you know, elements of cultural or ethnic destruction, and that the explanation that is given, I mean, just sweep that aside, that isn't going to help you understand what's really going on. It's sort of like trying to understand Ronald Reagan as an actor that became president. I mean, to me, this just seems incredibly far-fetched. He had, you know, zero kind of intellectual talents as he presented himself to the public, but he became this popular character. And then when you're looking back of him, you see, you know, Jewish gangsters, you see secret society member. I mean, everywhere. Well, first of all, Bohemian Grove. I mean, you have pictures of him and Nixon sitting in the OWL camp, for heaven's sake.
Sure. Yeah, this is in 1966 or something, yeah.
Right. I mean, so you've got an absolute
67 or something, yeah.
Spot. Yeah, but this is before I think either one of them had became president. And so here
you have two future presidents.
Right. It just happened to be at Bohemian Grove. Bohemian having Grove. Right.
Surrounded by business leaders. And,
with like, so clearly this is, their presidency has to be seen in this light, that you're dealing with, you know, the secret society is maneuvering these individuals into these roles. And then I think that, you know, with Reagan, the thing that I think is the most sinister about him was Star Wars. Star Wars really becomes eventually the technological slave state. You know, you start having all of the satellite technology with cameras and, and then all of the snooping, you know, stuff. And we still haven't gotten to the point where we understand what 5G is in terms of humanity. But all of this starts out with Reagan, and he says, well, you know, we've got to bring the commies to heel. And so that's the rationale, but I don't buy this. I think that they were intending to develop technology that would give them the technologic slave state, and Reagan is ground zero for that.
And it was also during his presidency that you begin this ballooning trade deficit and some of the monetary shenanigans, actually, which were started a decade before in the 70s with the petrodollar and the collapse of Bretton Woods and thing that Kissinger had set up. But in the 80s, you begin this gradual deindustrialization of the United States, which is inevitable given the macroeconomic policies. But despite him being very conservative, and at least superficially, there was a reaction to the excesses of the 60s and 70s, but also in the 80s, that's when divorce kicked in, became mainstream. And you had the explosion of the two-income families. Now, obviously, Reagan isn't solely responsible for this, but these things have been in the works for a long time. But it was in the 80s that you had, he also passed amnesty for bringing in mass immigration, doing the job for the oligarchs. It was in the 80s that the oligarchs decided to sort of break the unions and use bio-warfare, meaning demographic warfare, bringing in cheap labor to break the unions, deindustrialize, and kind of create the over-financialization of the U.S. economy we have today. And a lot of that was done under Ronald Reagan. Obviously, the deficits exploded under Reagan, and that we heard the thing that, you know, remember, deficits don't matter with the economy. Economy seemed to perform well under Reagan, and so he was popular. But really, the seeds for our bitter harvest today were sown during the Reagan administration.
Yeah, I mean, just as another, you know, important example, I mean, Reagan was a big free trade supposed proponent, you know, and he would actually bring up the Masonic cesspool Adam Smith and Wealth of Nations, which basically argued that the opium trade was an example of enlightened economy, you know, and so this was, Reagan, this kind of patriotic America is great and free trade is a good thing for us because, you know, we will always win because we're so wonderful and God, you know, has us as this special nation, but then other people will also share in the wonders of capitalism, you know, and so you know, this is all just, again, it's just maybe he's a complete moron, but I doubt it. I don't think anyone, you know, in his position would have you know, not understood where this was going to take us. I mean, now it's obviously, you know, we're being, the wealth of this nation is being gutted by so-called free trade. And this all goes to Reagan, and he creates this kind of propaganda aura around it, which is then referred to. You know, they'll actually talk about, you know, well, you know, Reagan was a huge proponent of free trade. Whenever anyone points out that, you know, all the jobs are being outsourced, but it actually all started with Reagan. And I mean, it didn't start with him, but certainly he did nothing really to protect the American worker per se. Just the opposite, you know. He opened up the American worker to, you know, dirt cheap competition, and at the same time, you know, he let the crazy people out of. I mean, if you look at it from a certain perspective, you can see that, you know, he's just a lifetime actor, just out there doing a malevolent thing after thing, and because he has a really good message and screen persona, he never gets called on it, and the American public get mind controlled into seeing him as this avuncular.
Well, I mean, compared to the idiots at Berkeley, I mean, if you're the solid middle class, the silent majority, which is all part of that dialectic, that's what the 60s dialectic was there to create, that reaction. And Reagan's there, you know, he's affable, he's witty, he has these jokes, you know. I remember there's one speech when he's governor of California, he goes, I saw a man, a protester, during the Vietnam War, a protester with a sign saying, you know, make love, not war. And he says, I don't think he was capable of either. You know, everyone laughs, of course. It's funny.
Yeah.
You know, and of course, he's cracked it at Berkeley. And again, it's very easy to be sympathetic for that because of the excesses of the protesters and the whole scene at Berkeley, which had been, you know, had been sort of created, or at least they've been sort of navigated into that part of the dialectic, you know.
I really wonder, you know, when he was at the Lookout Mountain, you know, kind of MK Ultra video laboratory, you know, I would love to have seen the kind of training he was being given and what they were studying. I mean, with Monroe, it's kind of easy to understand, you know, they were trying to develop effective pornography, I would assume. I mean, what else would she be doing there? But with Reagan, I really think that the character that he became for the American public was being developed. They were actually probably studying, you know, how he could be lovable, and you know, what kind of positions and jokes and what sort of level of, you know, kind of wit and things like this would be the most effective. They really, you know, manipulate us through personality.
Oh, it's like the on television, Archie Bunker, right?
Yeah.
You know, where actually he became the more popular character, because which maybe they didn't expect. But these are characters that that, you know, wholly created. And that's another thing is, again, this is if you talk about sort of the dark side of Ronald Reagan's political career, and you talk about these connections to the mob and the accusations and, you know, the fact that, you know, he clearly purged himself in the 50s and these things. When he was under oath, you know, about his dealings with MCA and his role as the president of the Screen Actors Guild. People who support him because of the persona they were given, his rhetoric, his speeches, what he seems to represent. And so if he really, and also the feeling that they have someone there fighting for them. They have a stake in the system. And if you point this stuff out, is they don't want to face up to that.
Yeah, well, look at the dialectic that goes on now, the contrasting of Trump to Obama.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, the people are passionate about this. They'll be fistfights, you know, if Trump is evil, or, you know, they love Trump. I mean, but just the passion that these two, you know, I would think obvious puppets of the oligarchs are able to create through this kind of idea of the dialectic, that people really believe that, you know, Trump is somehow different than Obama. Well, if he's so different, how come the wars are the same? And if he's so different, how come he doesn't do something different about the Federal Reserve, you know? So,
well, the deep state's been in control at least since the 1950s.
Yeah.
And they showed they flexed their muscle in 1963. Because if any president goes against, you know, that gravy train, the military-industrial complex, the he better learn to duck.
Yeah. Well, there it is, right?
You know, because this is the system, and the Praetorians will protect the system. The Praetorians are the one in charge, and that's what the CIA is all about. That's why it was created. I mean, it's not like a no mystery, and it was. I mean, it existed before in many forms. OSS was there, and obviously you had these type of machinations and intrigues that dragged the country into war. You know, in 1898, and also in 1917, and also 1941, but it became concretized after that with a permanent war. So we've been in a permanent crisis state, and these political figures like Reagan are there to step in and play these roles to be the leader to deal with a certain phase of these things.
And that's why I think it's important to really document their real history as best we can now, because I think in the future, you can see that the deep state is becoming more and more efficient and expert in terms of creating character. Mm-hmm. And so they will be able to cover up the backgrounds of the important parts of the background. So they will look, just like regular human beings, basically. Well,
look at Barack Obama.
Well, like Obama.
I mean, his history is so murky. It's like, I mean, I'd have to get a job, I have to provide more documentation and proof of my background than he did as president.
Yeah, it's amazing. But with Reagan, if you piece in there a little bit, at the beginning, I gave a few examples of what I think are important markers, mm-hmm. And it's important for us to document all this, because this is what we have as truth to be able to give the public, so they will recognize that there is an organization that controls both sides of the political mm-hmm. spectrum. I mean, this is why, like, Reagan's, invisible Freemason declaration is just critical in my mind, because it's just such an obvious marker, as is like his membership in the Bohemian Grove.
Yeah.
I mean, if you look at the Bohemian Grove now, they basically they're phasing out, because they know that these groups are under scrutiny. So you're phasing out, I think, Bohemian Grove and even Skull and Bones. I think they just turn them into cultural Marxist organizations where they bring in minorities and women and then just phase the thing out. It's no longer what it was at the origin. But back, if you just look at the photographs of Bohemian Grove, where they have like a body strung up, and you have all of these individuals around in Masonic outfits and giving Masonic hand signals, which are completely transparent, you can see that this is, really malevolent and just dangerous organization. And so then when you go forward, 20 or 30 years, and you see, Nixon and Reagan side by side at the OWL camp, well, I mean, what do you think? This is the secret society. These people are part of it. Therefore, when you look at them through the lenses of the pixelated reality, you're just looking at acting and narrative that's being creative to manipulate you.
Yeah.
And so it's going to be harder to see in the future, because they're going to be better and better at it. So I'm glad that we can document, the stuff that we can at this point.
These candidates are put up there, and they're sponsored, or they're picked, they're selected, and our politicians are selected. We call them, we don't have elections, we have selections. And the man that Reagan defeated to become president, Jimmy Carter, he was anointed or picked by, David Rockefeller, at the Tarrytown Mansion there, and he had a meeting with him. And of course, Carter himself was a trilateralist, and this Trilateral Commission was then a very new organization. It was created by the Rockefellers to sort of coordinate the expansion to Asia, I guess, because CFR is more European. But it's an example of a private organization that really runs the show for the oligarchs. They staff the administrations, the State Departments. And I think Carter's administration was like every other person was a member of the Trilateral Commission. But Carter was selected by David Rockefeller, anointed. And then after that, Carter was on the cover of magazines. Everyone was talking about him. And I think he was even... was it Time? There's a cover where they had instructed to try to make Carter look like Jack Kennedy on a cover or something.
Did you by any chance catch the Democratic?
No, debate? I haven't watched any debates, because it's just too nauseating.
And I think this is the first one I've seen in years, but I watched it. It was on television. I'm trying to think back why I watched it. I think because a significant person in my family had wanted to watch it. And so we watched it. And I mean, I really wonder if any of these people are basically, I mean, I think that most of them are actually just legitimately insane.
Yeah, I think you reached that point where the political puppet show was like that.
Yeah, I mean, they have the gay guy from South Bend.
Yeah, Buttigieg.
Yeah, I mean, whatever his name is. But he struck me as being legitimately nuts. I it's hard to believe they could actually create that thing. And then they had this, they had this black guy. I don't know where they got him from, but he's just, I mean, you just suffer with this guy, you know, because you know that he's just being manipulated and just made a fool. And then you see the actors, you know, they had Warren and Biden and Bernie Sanders in several tete-a-tetes, you know, with one another, you know, fighting. You know, these are real actors, you know, these are the deep state candidates, and they just have they're kind of set aside in a different way. You can kind of just see them. But, you know, I just think that, you know, watching it, I had the impression that as we go forward, they'll have more, you know, control over the political class. I mean, eventually to the point where I think it'll just be all computer animation, you know, where you won't even bother with human beings. They'll have like a, you know, Ronald Nixon or something, you know, and he will just meteoric rise and there won't be there, you know, he'll just be an animated
Max Headroom for president.
Max Headroom is kind of where we're headed, because these guys are, I just saw them as just, it was just tragic. They were either completely nuts or complete puppets, or just obvious, you know, manifestations of the deep state, like Sanders and Biden. The good thing about Biden, I think he is legitimately dementia at this point.
Yeah.
He's had a lot of facial plastic surgery, which makes him seem alert. But when he tries to talk, it's, you know, clearly they haven't been able to do the plastic surgery on his brain. And, you know, he's just old and slow-witted and, you know, sort of sad to see. But on the other hand, not really. So, yeah, so that was, you know, I don't see anyone coming forward that would have the kind of grip on the public that Reagan did. Boy, that one moment when he was talking about mourning in America and all this, he was really, you know, just, he had gotten to the heart. So it was very, very effective. I don't see any of that. I maybe they have someone coming out.
The country just simply isn't as unified as it was in the 80s.
To create a character like that now. Yeah. Because of the Marxism, you know, where you've got so many different groups that are.
The cultural shift since then. I mean, you and I were old, so it seems like it, not that long ago, the 80s, my coming of age. But if you compare, just the homogeneity that exists at the time, it doesn't. So you can't have a political figure like that anymore.
No,
different era, you know.
Well, I mean, been really great talking to you about Ronald Reagan. And all right, brother. Well, next week we'll do impeachment and the political class. See how.
Sounds good.
That stacks up.
Okay then.
Have a great weekend, brother.
What's left? Enjoy the rest of your weekend. Bye bye.
Bye.